Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. There are lots of incredibly smart people who have ended up working in finance, but there are few who combine intelligence and powerful insights with humility and humor. So I'm thrilled that one such person is our guest today. Morgan Stanley's former chief global strategist and for the last 25 years head of Independent Strategy, a research group who advise governments, central banks, sovereign wealth funds and other influential financial institutions about the global investment and geopolitical outlook. So David Roach, I'm thrilled to have you here as a guest today. David, you've authored some brilliant and extraordinarily accurate pieces and predictions. Perestroika, predicting the collapse of the Soviet Union. Pricing Power to the People, about the internet's revolutionary impact on lowering prices. And more recently, some really thought-provoking work about the post-COVID landscape. David, you're our first Irishman on the show, graduate of Trinity College Dublin. You started your career at ICI, did an MBA at INSEAD, and moved to financial services with JP Morgan. 10 years later, you become their strategist and switch from one Morgan to the other. What was the motivation to change firms?
I think the motivation was to stay in strategy and research. Of course, there are other material things, like the money was infinitely better, as you can imagine. Of course, a very different sort of firm. But I took it on the basis that I could continue doing what I wanted to do.
So you become Morgan Stanley's European and then global strategist, and you were given a large remit to travel and write?
So, of course, it wasn't quite the disciplined and regulated industry it is today. I mean, I think there was one lawyer in London, and there certainly wasn't any PR person. And the entire research department, if I remember rightly, had about three people whom I recruited from various corners of Europe. Their aim was to get up the rankings and to be noticed. The more you were noticed, of course, the more you would attract business, but also the more you were noticed as a firm, the more you would attract analysts, which we lacked in Morgan Stanley at the time. I had a free rein to go and travel in Eastern Europe at the time, and it was critical to do so just before the fall of the wall. I had a free rein to pretty well say anything and do anything. I mean, there was an editor, not like an editor who ensures that what you're saying is politically and correct and matches what the firm wishes to look like and so on. It was an editor who basically put punctuation and shortened my sentences. So you had a wonderful time.
I will share with the listeners, because I was at Morgan Stanley during that period. I remember you wrote a particularly controversial piece of research on Italy. I think it was called Italy, the Failed State. And it so happened the next day the investment bankers were pitching for the privatization of Telecom Italia. Is that right?
I think that's probably right. Yes, yes, yes. I think senior people in New York wrote a letter to the Italian state saying, well, of course, don't think for one moment that what David Roach says represents what we think of Italy, blah, blah, blah. There was friction. And the only thing the friction did was get worse. Over the next 5 to 10 years, got worse and worse.
And so that led to the birth of Independent Strategy, almost inevitably, I suppose.
Yes, yes. And I must say that Independent Strategy has surprised me in lasting 30 years. In those days, of course, there was no really independent research in the sense of being a little company out there publishing your own thing. All research came out of brokers or out of investment banks. So we were kind of unique in that sense, and I think that helped us. We also got a lot of backing from people who had followed me when I was at Morgan Stanley. So the firm was pretty well underwritten, and it was a lot of fun. Of course, financially, it's a suicidal thing to do.
But to sustain an investment research business, as you have done, is extremely unusual. And what do your clients think is your secret sauce?
Oh, I think coming up with ideas which are kind of not trading ideas, but represent sort of, to use a terrible word, plates, tectonic plates, things which are going to really make a difference, not for the next 10 minutes, 10 hours, or 10 months even, but much longer term. Another reason is I'm very keen on writing decent English so that people actually enjoy reading the stuff, even if they don't agree with it.
Well, maybe that'll be revealed in the next few topics we're going to discuss. And I'd like to jump in to China. You have lived in Hong Kong for, I think, nearly the last 20 years. And so you've had a ringside seat to unfolding events. And we've got listeners in over 40 countries on the Money Maze podcast. And so let's maybe start with a slightly different question about culture, which is, you've made the point that China doesn't have a modern novel. And I wonder what that is telling us.
Well, I think it clears the decks for behaving exactly how you want, because you don't have to conform with a cultural principle. And after all, literature is really a form of conscience. You can do what you want, basically. You don't have any constraints in an ethical sense, or very many. Now, of course, China has got a lot of extremely good artists, most of whom happen to live abroad. I'm sure you've seen the exhibitions, and they're not exactly flavor of the month in China. When you are, let's say, Irish, you get up in the morning and you're confused probably by literature, James Joyce, public conscience, things you feel shouldn't be going on in the state and are going on in the state, probably by some vestige of religion and so on. It's all there. Well, if you wake up in the morning in China, you're not confused. There's two aims you can pursue. And it is a gross simplification, but it's nevertheless relevant. You can go after the last dollar on the face of the earth, and you can go after the maximizing the status of China, or both, given how politics gets itself paid. And I think that is different. It means that they are uninhibited in their pursuit of their goals. I'd put it that way.
Right. You've also written that you think that China and others are overestimating their strength. Could you maybe explain that a little?
I'd say a couple of things. One is, to get where China wants to be, which is at least parallel with the US on the global geopolitical stage, you need technology. Now, China has a lot of technology, but it lacks technology in specific areas which are necessary to achieve those goals. And I would mention the high end of processors, chips, robotics, GPS for military applications, which, although they're putting up their own system, is still dominated by America and then Russia. And all of these things mean that actually China remains more dependent on foreign input, which can and is being cut off, than their self-confidence would seem to indicate that they are aware of. I choose my words very carefully there, all along. So that's one area in which, just to be specific, in which I think China is overestimating. In another area, China's social contract is that everybody accepts the predominance of the Communist Party, the rule of the state, in return for constantly rising living standards and better lives for their children. And indeed, that has worked extremely well. But whatever way we go, whether it's because international trade, deglobalization is going to damage international trade, which of course impacts the Chinese economy, or because leverage in China is so high and entails so much unproductive capital, the growth rate in Chinese living standards is about to halve. Put it another way, living standards doubled every 13 years. It's now more likely that living standards will double every 25 or 30 years. Does that preserve the social contract? Do people still sign off on the predominance of the party and everything that it does? And the third area in which China, I think, is overstepping itself is in its military confrontation with the United States. Now, it's catching up very fast, but the area of confrontation around Taiwan, the relocation of American forces to the Asia-Pacific theater with 3 out of 5 major aircraft carriers now located in that area, and the ability of the Americans, for all the arguments one can make that America is in the longer term a declining power, which I would tend to agree with, nevertheless, right now, America is probably capable of inflicting the most terrible damage on Chinese communications if push ever came to shove, about Taiwan or anything else. So on those three things, I think that China is making itself too many enemies at the present time. I would be much more like Deng Xiaoping and say, okay, well, let's stay quiet until we're really, really strong, and then we can make noises and we can be more aggressive. But let's be quiet now. That's what it was, Deng Xiaoping's philosophy was. And I think, like one of Marlowe's overreachers, I think he's overreaching.
So we've seen what's happened in Hong Kong and the tearing up of the one country, two systems contract. And you talk about Taiwan, but is the move on Hong Kong a precursor to trying a full move on Taiwan?
Well, it can't be a precursor in the sense that there's no one country, two system paper, to use your word, Simon, to tear up. But of course, Taiwan is watching Hong Kong, and Taiwan is saying now that one country, two system will never be applied in Taiwan because Taiwan is a full-blown democracy. So the worse or the more extreme the measures taken by China in Hong Kong, the more that makes Taiwan hostile to any rapprochement with China. Taiwan is the big fish in all this. I mean, let's face it, Hong Kong is a small city in China. That's the beginning and that's the end of it. It can be absorbed. It can be ignored. It can, in many ways, be made irrelevant economically within the greater Bay Area of China. Taiwan is a basket of different kettle of fish. And the real aim for China is to reunite, in inverted commas, with Taiwan. And I think the influence of what happens in Hong Kong upon the ability of China to do that in a peaceful manner is very, very marked.
And how do you think about what is a growing discomfort in the West? We've got the new, I think it's in the UK, it's the China Reform Group, and you've had more noises coming out of the US. At the same time, we've had 1 million Muslims locked up or detained. Do they think that COVID's been a distraction and that gives them room for maneuver?
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. But of course, COVID has actually had the opposite result. It has made people in the West, unjustifiably, in my opinion, blame China for the thing happening. So it has actually made the West much more hostile to China than they were before. So instead of being a nice cover story for getting on with the idea of making Hong Kong's opposition to Chinese rule quiescent, it actually has done the opposite. Hong Kong has now become, in a sense, a piece on the chessboard of the geopolitical strategy being played out between China and the West. The West is the wrong word because it includes, of course, everybody from Korea, Japan, to the whole way around the world, but let's use the word the West. And what happens in Hong Kong will influence what happens on trade. What happens on trade, which is being tightened all the time of what widgets you can export to China without permission from the US, if things get worse in Hong Kong and are visibly worse, then the tightening of trade will be more extreme and more sudden. And that feeds back into the ability of China to access the technology that they need, which is central to their targets as regards economic growth. It's central to their targets as regards the military. It's central to how their consumer model works. So Hong Kong has now, instead of becoming something that they could be dealt with while people were distracted by COVID, it's actually become a focal point as a consequence of COVID, more than being hidden by COVID.
And whilst Hong Kong's economic importance has diminished a percentage of the whole Chinese economy, are we looking at a slow decline in Hong Kong, number one, and the Hong Kong dollar itself, unusually tied to the US dollar? Are we looking at a point in time when that ceases to exist?
I think the problem in Hong Kong is that if the youth of Hong Kong is offered the opportunity to live someplace else, many, many talented young people will take that option. That's number one. And that could come, as you know, Boris Johnson has started the process of allowing these people to have one-year visas, which can be extended and can even lead to citizenship. That sort of thing would be extremely negative for Hong Kong. The second thing is, while trade restrictions from the US on Hong Kong can be worked out by economists as not being that big because, put it this way, most of the goods that go to, say, the United States or Europe from Hong Kong actually come from China. So they're taxed by source. They're not taxed by transit. So the actual impact on Hong Kong of trade sanctions itself would probably be, in GDP terms, fairly minor. But of course, in terms of psychology, they would be huge. Because if people can be tried here for the various political crimes which have been named in the draft Security Act, the Article 23 being drafted in China, then I think people will say, well, gosh, this is really kind of a risky area because we could have members of staff who simply disappear overnight. Why would we go there? So I think the actual impact of this legislation is much bigger than the economic figures would seem to indicate.
So I guess the final question I have on the China piece is, despite this increasingly authoritarian and some would say unpleasant dictatorship, what about its currency in terms of how would you see the currency evolve on the world stage?
It's been remarkably immune to what is going on. It's trading, what, about 708, 712 at the moment against the US dollar. It's been up and down a bit. It weakened during the COVID crisis and the end of the COVID crisis. And when this particular problem, when it became clear that the Chinese were going to draft their own Security Act, Article 23 for Hong Kong, it weakened a bit. But then, of course, you had the Fed printing a bucket load of money, which reduced interest rates in the United States to nothing. They weren't very much to begin with, and now they're less. So what that actually does is make the renminbi look like a carry trade. You can get 2% for 1 year paper. So why wouldn't you take that? And you've actually seen capital flows into both Hong Kong and into renminbi. There was a renminbi issuance by the mainland government in Hong Kong, I think, a couple of days ago, 19 times oversubscribed. So you're not looking at a collapse. What you are looking at is if China is going to be struggling in terms of growth and trade, and they are linked, but not umbilically linked anymore because exports are now only about 20% of GDP or less, and they were about 40. So, but nevertheless, the two are linked. If you get to a position where China is struggling to maintain growth domestically and internationally, then there's no reason for China to maintain the currency where it is. So in a sense, what they're doing is they're being very good about the currency because of the trade deal with the United States. If such thing has come to an end, there's no reason to actually maintain a strong currency. Then the only constraint on the currency is at what level, or if it was allowed to weaken, how much would it be allowed to weaken without setting off hot money outflows, which would then sabotage economic policy domestically in all sorts of ways. They always have to balance that. But I don't see a collapse in the renminbi, but what I would see is a progressive weakening.
I want to return to a theme that you dubbed back in 1990, pricing power to the people. And that piece that you put out described how globalization would lower the price of things, making for happy consumers, not because they earned more, but because what they earned could buy more. At the same time, corporations would make more money by shifting higher volumes at cheaper production costs. Now we have had, perhaps we already had, the beginning of de-globalization strains, but possibly a new architecture that emerges post this pandemic. And I wonder if you could just talk about how you're thinking.
Well, thinking about the past, first of all, the idea of pricing power to the people, which is 30 years old as an idea, came from the opening up of China, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, in a sense, the gulags entering the labor market. And this depressed, of course, the cost of making things. And so the idea was, together with the fact that central banks were now embedded in their fight against inflation, that the way money would be made by corporations was by shifting volume at lower margins, but not by shifting less volume at higher margins, because they would not have the pricing power to do that. Therefore, the price they paid for their labor was kind of socially okay, because what that money could buy every year increased. And it increased because things got cheaper. That was pricing part of people. Okay, well, that was a lovely idea. It missed some points, by the way. It entirely missed the issue of equity, of how these benefits would be split in society, and the fact that inflation coming down, interest rates coming down would boost asset values enormously. And the benefit of those rising asset prices would be concentrated in very few hands socially. And this kind of created, it didn't only create the disparities in wealth, it actually created the disparities in culture about wealth. It actually led to the creation of the culture of the yellow Lamborghini. Very nice motor car, but driven by most awful people. Now, let's look at the future. Okay, I think it's changed. I think that idea is dead. There are several reasons, but they are focused around the post-COVID world. I think the post-COVID world will be one of big government, making society kinder and nicer, but in an inefficient manner. Much of the cost of this will be, of course, through taxation, principally the rich and corporations. But the reality is that big government is never productive government. And if you have unproductive government, you get lower growth and higher inflation. That's number one. Number two is we're returning to something akin to national economics from globalized economics. Nobody wants to be at risk in a corporation from interruption to supply chains anymore. So they will pay a premium in terms of efficiency for deglobalizing. Now that, of course, the obvious things are things like PPE clothing for medical services and face masks and all that sort of thing. But it goes way beyond that. It's going to affect practically every manufacturing production line you look at. Slightly less in services, but much more in terms of manufacturing production lines are going to be repatriated or brought closer to home. You may not end up making textiles in Frankfurt, but you certainly may end up making them in Turkey rather than Bangladesh or China. And similarly, you may make your cars and your IT components in Mexico rather than in China. In any case, things get more national. The reason why things got cheaper was because of globalization. So what actually happens is you get cost push inflation. It's a lower growth, lower productive type of economy. And the cost push comes from the fact that you are reversing the very process of globalization, which led to a fall in the price of things for decades. So that goes backwards. And the final point I would make is that while all this is happening, certain types of services provided to individuals and so on, like the FANGs, like Facebook, like Google, and so on, are going to become even more world dominant. Now, their model, which was based on using your data to sell to another party so that you didn't have to pay for your access to their system, that model is going to become out of the question, because these corporations in the main are going to be policed and regulated much more like a utility than they ever were before. And therefore, they have to come up with another way of making money. That other way of making money is charging you. So the world dominance plus what they deliver will become a charged service, and it will add to inflation because it is so important in what society is going to be doing, whether it's monitoring people if they're well or not well or getting in and out of a building or whatever. These corporations are going to be the ones supplying those services, and they're going to be paid services.
And that's at the very time that these top technology platform companies occupy nearly 20% of the S&P. So does that, in your mind, suggest that we've seen the peak in their concentrated power as a weight?
I think that is correct. Yes. I certainly would be very hesitant about recommending them at the moment. Perhaps there is another point to make. They will become dominant in the liberal market, call it the Western system, which includes Japan and so on and so forth. They will become dominant in those areas, but of course, they're not going to get into China. China does and will substitute its own controlled giant corporations for each of the ones we have in the West. So in that sense, they could become at risk from the sort of protectionism which I think we're going to see to counter China. In other words, I see China and almost the rest of the world, not everybody, but most of it, getting into a Cold War situation. And that Cold War will be fought out through technology and trade very visibly. And that will affect, of course, all of these stocks, which are dearly beloved by the market, because can you imagine a tech company with a national economic model? No, every single tech company in the world is a spider's web, a network of globalized entities, communicating, selling, transferring knowledge, and so on. If that becomes interrupted, as it probably will in the Cold War between China and the rest, it is likely that those tech stocks will be seen to be vulnerable. Their economic model will be seen to be vulnerable, even though they are dominant within the Western market system and use that to their advantage in pricing.
This landscape that you see is one of lower productivity, higher inflation, a return to national economics. What are the three things you're thinking investors should do from an asset allocation standpoint?
I think the first is to make sure you don't lose money. It's going to be much harder work. I would certainly hold gold because I think the gold price is probably going to go to 2,500 even this year. But it does provide a hedge against the debasement of currencies, which are part and parcel of all this, because after all, what I see happening as regards monetary policy in this sort of environment is that central banks and finance ministries are the front and back door of the same building. The governments issue the debt. The central bank buys the debt. When the debt gets too big, the central bank writes down the asset and the government writes down the liability. And we recreated Japan all over again, in a sense. You want to get out of your way of that. So gold is one thing you should own. The second thing you should own, I'm not saying I would put all of my money in it, but I would definitely work out the areas in the post-COVID world, which sectors are going to win. Now, the kind of stay-at-home sector, the DIY sector, the healthcare sector. I mean, I could name about 10 or 15 sectors which are going to be the ones which actually are at the forefront of the transformation from the pre-COVID to the post-COVID world. And those are sectors of equities that one should own. Bonds is very difficult, very, very difficult indeed. I really, except as a kind of safe haven thing, I would be very wary of chasing yield around the world. And in those countries where you do own bonds, it's really as a safe haven asset, but it's not because you will get paid good yields or that you will make a big capital gain, because I think the bond yields will be held at extremely low levels so that governments can run extremely high levels of debt, which they don't want to solve, because if they had to solve it, they'd deflate all the economies, which coming on top of COVID would hardly make them electable. So the bond yields will be held down to facilitate this kind of symbiotic relationship between central banks and governments, fiscal policy.
So that allows us probably to turn quite neatly to the part of the world where some of these tensions have been on the front page, and that's Europe. And I think that you are less pessimistic than some about the future of the euro area.
Yes, I think we'll all be surprised to come back in 10 years and find the euro is still there and Germany is still leading it and the weak economies are still the weak economies, and that we've been through umpteen crises and that none of it actually meant the 5 days left to save the euro, if I remember the headline. It'll still be there. Now, I'd make a couple of points about Europe. Europe actually created the post-COVID world before COVID happened, because if you go back to the origins and how Sozialmarktwirtschaft, so social market system in Germany, created an extremely powerful German economic system on a global scale, it had scant reference to markets, shareholder value, or any of that. It was actually built upon a model of the state not owning the assets, but intervening in the marketplace in a way that ensured both growth, productive investment, and equity. Now, if you then jump to COVID, you find, lo and behold, in Europe, there are approximately 30 million people who are employed by companies where there is no work to do. These are people who are skilled workers mainly, say about 10 or 11 million in Germany alone, skilled workers, who are not fired because government pays the corporation to pay them to stay at their post. Now, what that means is, first of all, it's the absolute embodiment of Sozialmarktwirtschaft, but it lessens the social pain of COVID. It lessens the inequality, which COVID is the natural creator of, enormously. And it means that the corporate sector, when it opens up and starts to produce things again, has got its skilled workforce in place because they never fired them. Now, I don't wish to say, and I'm sure there will be people screaming in America, this is totally unfair, not at all the way things should work. You should fire everybody and then get them back and get better people back and so on and so forth. Well, that's all very nice. In reality, this is Sozialmarktwirtschaft at work in a post-COVID world. And I think the strength of Europe is that it has already created nearly 80%, 90% of the way that economies will function after COVID-19. But the UK, the US, and so on have to learn how this will be. And Europe never unlearned how this will be. So I think that is an advantage. It's a weird advantage, but it's an advantage. Now, there are other things I think that, unlike everybody else, I actually think that the new generation European Commission plan under von der Leyen is quite clever. And I think she is a completely different quality of leadership than Jean-Paul Juncker. And it will get someplace. And I think the ECB is really being about incredibly proactive, because the amount, the 1.4 trillion or so euros they've kind of authorized themselves to buy bonds with, is actually equal to the budget deficits of Europe over the next 2 years. So for a government to go bust over the next 2 years is going to be extremely difficult. So that also works in its favor. And then third of all is the structure of Europe. Europe is like a jellyfish. You can dance on it and it wobbles and then goes away, swims off in another direction. But it's extremely difficult to kill it. It absorbs shock. It's not very good at getting things done, but it absorbs shocks extremely well. So that's why I think the euro will be there, that Europe will survive and probably do a bit better.
Right. As the expression goes, as states make wars, so wars make states. And I guess that COVID is a type of a war. Before we go into some general questions, I do want to dip back to Russia. You authored this fantastically insightful piece about Perestroika, the breaking down of the Berlin Wall. You'd done documentaries of Eastern Europe as well years ago. Is Russia just sort of a bit part player in all of these developments?
Russia, in every way, economically, demographically, is a declining state. Now, in a sense, we're all demographically declining states. But if you actually look at the Russian statistics, despite the fact that Putin has inspired enough confidence in the Russian people to create more babies than people are dying, which is, I suppose, one of the achievements of his regime, it's still a terrible demographic state and it's a terrible economic state. It has never really broken away from its dependence on minerals and energy, not at all. But it is a fiscally conservatively run state, so it's not about to blow up or anything like that. But I would say economically, it will decline. The Chinese will buy bigger and bigger slices of it, because every time we put sanctions on Russia, guess who steps in to satisfy any shortage created by the sanctions? It's the Chinese. We don't make a song and dance about it, but actually they just replace. Every time Europe puts on restrictions on Russia, the Chinese act economically to take them off again. And we all say nothing, because we've been very busy accommodating China, taking a more significant role everywhere in the world, including Russia. The thing about the Russian state is that it does have technological excellence in military matters. And it has a fighting force which has been seasoned by war, particularly in the Middle East, and is pretty professional. But it is not, as a country or an economy, big enough or strong enough to actually run a global confrontation like the Soviet Union did or thought it could. Russia will continue to be a power which cannot be ignored and will stir up trouble in specific flashpoints in the world. But it will not assume a face-to-face confrontation with the West, which I think China will. So in that sense, I would say Russia will move closer to China, will not reverse its long-term decline, but will continue to be a force to be reckoned with militarily in places as far away as the Middle East and Venezuela, as we've seen, and there will be many others.
And if you look back on your terrifically successful and varied career, is there anything that you would have done differently?
I wouldn't do this at all. I mean, I became strategist completely by accident. But so you're actually asking the question about reincarnation. What would you like to do when you came back? Well, you're obviously not going to do the same bloody thing again. You do something different. So I would do something different. I think I would probably have stuck to some form of creative writing. Now, I'm not talking about what I write now, which is so, to quote Somerset Maugham, it's so distinctly second class.
That leads us to a really important question for the youth audience that we have, is that what would you encourage the young to look for in jobs? Where should they be looking?
Well, the first thing is to look inside yourself and do what you're passionate about. I was, am passionate about world affairs and about writing halfway decent English. And I managed to pursue a career all my life in writing about something that really interests. So the first thing they've got to do is to look inside themselves. you have to really be totally cliche ridden and say that by the time they are 40, 80% of the world economy will be tech of one sort or another. It'll be the software, it'll be the hardware, the services which it will render are unimaginable today. Who would have imagined you and I doing this when I was in ICI and we had a department of 8 people planning petrochemical sites in Wilhelmshaven, and we had one calculator between the 8 people, and that calculator was not electric. And now look at what we're doing. So we have no idea where that demand is going to be and where the services are going to be, but that's where the growth is going to be. It's not going to be in industry, it's not going to be in strategy, it's not going to be in financial investment, which will all have been taken over by some weird logarithm. It's going to be in the provision of 80% of GDP in products and services that we have no idea about now. So what you have to do is maintain, rather than saying, I'm going to be a programmer or I'm going to design silicon chips, you have to say, I want to be a part of this. I'm going to be flexible enough in my mind to spot the opportunity.
I want to thank you again for being on the show, for your wonderful insights and your good advice. I'm going to particularly take two things with me that you have said. One is that this deglobalization is with us and with consequences for higher inflation and reordered supply chains. And secondly, that the EU is going to be a survivor in this because it's actually better suited to the return to national economics. There are many other things that I've learned, and hopefully our listeners will have learned and enjoyed. But for now, until we have you back again, David, very best wishes and thank you so much.
Good to be on, Simon. Thanks a lot. You better hurry and have me back.
Thank you for listening to this episode. The Money Maze podcast is free, and if you liked what you heard, please write a review on iTunes or Google Play to help others discover the show. If you'd like to keep up with our work, please search the Money Maze podcast on LinkedIn, at Money Maze podcast on Facebook, or at Money Maze podcast on Instagram. Finally, you'll find other information at our website, www.moneymazepodcast.com. Until next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.